Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, it's a good job we recorded a separate podcast about 7 hours ago, really, because if you wanted to know about what happened to Serena Williams, you'd be coming to the wrong place, because I can barely remember any of that. Fortunately, there's an emergency tennis podcast already waiting for you elsewhere in our feed, if you'd like to listen to that, and about Caroline Wozniacki's end to her career at the hands of Ons Jabeur. We have now moved from Garden Square, where we were speaking to you on that earlier podcast today, and soaked up the most epic 7 or 8 hours of tennis. Not all of it the greatest quality in the world, but drama wherever you looked. And now we have returned to Catherine's Lounge, where there are snacks and there are beers and there are tired faces.
And seats.
And seats. Yeah, because we were standing up next to
someone Bowery.
Yeah, see, it's a long time ago.
Genuinely forgotten her name.
It's a long time ago. Leslie, I think.
Leslie.
Was it Leslie?
Yes.
Okay.
That you've saved us there, David.
Brilliant. So, yeah, just to run you through the day. So we had the Serena defeat at the hands of Wang Chang. We had Caroline Wozniacki's retirement and all the rest of it. And then we had the evening session commencing, and this is the snapshot of what happened. We had Coco Gauff, age 15, knocking out the defending champion Naomi Osaka. We had Stefanos Tsitsipas going out in 3 straight sets to Milos Raonic, and then we had Roger Federer in a 5-set epic that he was 8-4 down in the final set tiebreak against John Millman, and he eventually won 6 points in a row to get the win, and so Federer is still alive here in the Australian Open.
Yes. Despite his demons.
Yes.
Turns out John Millman is a sensation.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I'm feeling a great sense of responsibility with this podcast, because I feel like, you know, we have quite a lot of listeners in America who would have probably slept through all that. I was messaging Andrew, our good friend and colleague, who said, I feel like I need the podcast more than ever, because I feel like I've been in a blackout and woken up and I need someone to tell me how my night's gone off the rails. Just because...
I think that's how Tsitsipas feels as well.
Yeah, just because everything just continued to be crazy. I mean, we were kind of right that the night session this evening would be amazing. I think we all thought that would be the case. It was arguably the day session which was more surprising in its drama, but yeah, the night session for its sustained drama to 1 o'clock was extraordinary.
I don't know why I'm volunteering this, because it's not required, but I thought Millman Federer was going to be disappointing. I thought it was going to be the inverse of kind of the Wong Serena thing, where it was just a far superior match, ludicrously so compared to what we saw at the US. I thought it was going to be disappointingly pedestrian.
For Federer.
Yeah.
Right.
I would have said the same yesterday, but there was something in the air. It's like this snowball effect. As soon as one happens, it seems to affect all the others.
I can't cope with that, because no. I know you're right, but it defies logic, and I can't cope with it.
But I quite like occasionally leaving logic to one side and just going with
so is it,
craziness.
Is it that then? Is there something in the air that catches and everybody ends up getting this sense of being uncertain and uncomfortable? And
I'm sure players would say no. I'm sure players would say, oh, I'm just focusing on my match. But that feels like a line that they might just trot out.
Of course, yeah. Do you think, how closely do we think Naomi Osaka watched the Serena match, for example?
Pretty closely.
Yeah.
I don't think she'd be very good at ignoring it all.
No.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's pick up there, shall we? Because Osaka and Goff came onto the court. I was commentating on it on BBC Radio. I did the first set. Right from the off, I felt like I'm looking at a different Coco Gauff, for instance, than I saw at Wimbledon last year. She wasn't just reacting to her opponent. That was the big thing that I took from it. I know you've referenced the power of her serve, and it is just a thud of a serve. But her ground stroke, she was taking it to Osaka today and dictating the play. Osaka was awful.
Mm.
I mean, it was just an appalling performance. She really didn't show up. Part of it was Gauff making it difficult because she didn't allow her to play, but Osaka is good enough to force her way into a tennis match, and she just didn't.
But is that the problem, though, that she was trying to force her way in? She was trying to just hit through it, and it ended up making her look, dare I say, one-dimensional. Yeah.
She hit two successive backhands down the line on one knee halfway up the net. You know, just shots that really are... When somebody's hit a really spearing backhand cross-court at you and you're trying to change the direction of it and go over the high part of the net. And I was with Daniela Antekova, she was the co-commentator, and she's just... That shot's just not on, really. When you're feeling like this, you've got to be feeling $1 million to hit a shot like that. Her mind was scrambled, I think.
Yeah, I left the stadium. I went out after the first set and saw the second set in the stadium. And then once it had finished, I thought, I have no way to explain what just happened. That was just an error fest from Osaka. But I thought, well, at least I'll go to the press conference and Osaka will probably have some kind of explanation for it, because she so often does. She didn't. She was as confused as we were by that performance. And I actually thought she slightly contradicted what she's been saying all tournament, really, which is that she feels like she's getting better at getting through matches when she's not playing her best but still managing to win. But then today she said that she thinks that's something she still really lacks. In fact, she used the expression, "I lack the champion's mentality," and then described that in those terms of, in terms of winning when you're not at your best. So, yeah, I was left even more confused by Osaka. There were just so many errors. I mean, Gauff played fine, but I can't really remember a moment where I thought, wow, Coco Gauff was amazing.
I'll tell you one moment that I did, and this is where I'd never seen a play where I sit in a commentary box for Five Live here in the Australian Open, which is on... You are basically sitting on the court just behind the centre service line judge. That's where our window is. It's blacked out, so you can't see it from the TV. But we're sitting there, and it's where you appreciate the movement most of all, because the player is 20 feet in front of you, moving side to side. And her movement, her ability to, A, move side to side, but then change direction when she was even wrong-footed. I don't know that I've seen anybody else move like that in the women's game.
Yeah, that was something that struck me the other day.
And still control the shot, still have a decision, the ability to make a decision on the run. I mean, it was just jaw-dropping.
I know she was helped significantly by Osaka, but what struck me is that so many of her victories at these three slams where we've seen her emerge have fed on the drama and her competitive instinct. There have been have there been any just straightforward sort of Gauff's just the better player and that's the end of it?
Maybe only the first one against Venus at Wimbledon when Venus was totally off her game.
The others have all been, you know, she's produced great tennis, but it's what has stood out above everything is her instincts, her competitive fighting instincts, and she's had to battle, which in some respects has made it more impressive. What she hasn't been doing is just routine victories where she's just the better player. And yeah, Osaka was a big factor in that today, but Goff was just the better player.
The next step in her development will be when she develops just maybe one or two more weapons, which are coming. I mean, given the age she is, she's going to grow more strength. She's probably 3-4 years away from being close to her peak. And she'll start beating players routinely in
3 or 4 years. That's 18 or 19.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that. I don't know. I mean, you never know when somebody might go through a bad patch and struggle for a while and might have it may not all be just a straightforward upward curve.
No, but I'm thinking sort of in average terms for female tennis players, what is the average peak age? It wouldn't be 18 or 19. I know she's an anomaly, but...
No, I mean, look, she could easily have 20 years in the sport. Gosh. Easily. If physically she's okay and mentally and everything else. But I just feel like at the moment, most of her wins are punctuated by the fact that she's grinding out victories against veteran players and experienced players, which is an incredible trait and ability to have at the age she is. But in order to take the next step, she'll have to start cleaning people up.
And she has already improved her game. In terms of, I remember watching her forehand at Wimbledon last year and being struck by how loopy it was. I almost thought that was what she was intending to do. Like, it was like it was a new shot. I'd never seen anything like it before. It would look like it was going out and then just suddenly dip, and it would make no sound as it made contact with the strings.
It's like the moon ball, but like not as a junk shot.
Yeah. But now she seems to have really cleaned up the strike on that forehand, and it's not as good as her backhand, I don't think, but it's come on a long way. And there was something about her that just disrupted Osaka, and as probably the most insightful thing that Osaka said in her press conference was that I love Coco, but I really didn't like losing to her. She felt that, you know, and she referenced her age. She said it's not good to lose to a 15-year-old, and I kind of loved that from Osaka. And she was asked to compare what she was like when she was 15 and what her expectations were of her own career. And she said, well, they were the same, but I just expected to be where I am now sooner. And we kind of think of Osaka as pretty young, really, and having made a big breakthrough. So it's almost like she's a bit in awe of what Goff's been being able to do. And she kind of wants to be able to do that herself, but she can't because it's all in the past for her. She's now older.
Oh, God, she's like having regrets at 22.
I mentioned we had Daniela Hantikova in our commentary box. She picked her to win the title.
Goff.
Yeah.
Not the first time she's gone big.
I love Daniela, as is well known. She's been high on Coco Goff for a long time. I do take that with a little pinch of salt, but it is possible. Of course it's possible.
Yeah.
But
do you know what? One thing that does occur to me, because whilst I was thinking, you know, that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is I think of less than a year ago, I think of Felix Auger-Aliassime, who was rising so relentlessly that you couldn't imagine a blip, really, and now he's having a blip. I'm not saying I expected him to sort of win a Grand Slam this year. A year ago, I didn't think that, but I didn't think he would play players and suddenly look like he's got the yips on a shot or something like that, or be missing the way he is. Who knows whether Goff may end up having that?
Of course she's going to have blips.
Oh yeah,
of course. I mean, it's all relative. She's not going to always be reaching the second week of slams, so she's going to have blips.
And actually, mentally, that's quite a challenge, I think, for these young players. I always remember, I mean, before your time, when I was a kid, and Boris Becker won Wimbledon in 1985, and then he won it in 1986, and me as a 12, 13-year-old didn't know what it was like to see Boris Becker lose. I'd never seen it before, because we only saw Wimbledon, so I'd only ever seen Boris Becker win. And then in 1987, he lost in the second round. And it was just, I can't tell you how big a shock that seemed.
This is like us with Andreescu circa October 2019, yes, when we realised we'd never seen her lose.
Yeah. And Audra Aliassime is actually a good comparison, I think, because I feel like Audra Aliassime's name has been known for a long time. People have known that this Canadian was coming, in the same way people have known about Coco Gauff.
Yeah, Shapovalov used to say, when he was having his breakthrough, oh, you think I'm good.
Yeah,
wait till you see Felix. Yeah.
We always dine out on a line like that, don't we?
Yeah.
He's the next this or that.
Although I think Djokovic might have said that about his brother.
He did, yeah.
Didn't quite work out.
I remember Nicholas Lapenti saying it about his brother, Giovanni Lapenti. And Giovanni Lapenti did beat Arvind Palmer in the final rubber of the Davis Cup in, I think, about 2000.
Imagine being the least good Lapenti.
And, I mean, come on, Nicholas Lapenti was pretty good. He was a top 10 player.
I know, but it's not like saying I'm Andre Agassi's slightly less good. It's not like being Patrick McEnroe is my... I'm obviously being mean.
What gets me, though, is Giovanni Lapenti... That was he was 17 when he had that Davis Cup result. And honestly, I thought we were looking at the next big star. And I never
Giovanni Lapenti.
Yeah, I never heard of him again. Really.
Actually, thank goodness that was before Twitter, David.
I did see him
Can
when
you
he was
imagine if you'd nailed your colours to the mast?
I've done a few of those on Twitter as well over the years. Anyway.
Great thing to do on Twitter is to just put in your @. So put in @ David Lord Tennis and just put a random tennis player's name, and you'll see tweets.
Definitely don't want to do that.
Yeah,
Matt.
And you'll see tweets from, like, I don't know, 2014 with takes on Tommy Robredo or whatever.
If there was a way to sort of filter my tweets by takes, it would be a shocking sight, I tell you.
I don't just mean your Twitter, by the way, David. I mean, this applies to everyone's Twitter.
Right, okay. So that was Coco Gauff, and who does Coco Gauff play now?
So Coco Gauff plays Sophia / Sonia Kenin.
Oh, I tell you, that could be quite tough.
Yeah, it's
I think
a really
that is tough.
It's a
different
really,
type of match,
yep.
That.
Mm. And it's a very open section of the draw.
She won't give her anything.
She's not going to get errors, yep.
Mm. And Kenin's
relentless.
Will take great pleasure in wrecking that party. Mm.
Yep.
And then the winner of that plays the winner of Jabeur Chong Wong for a place in the semis.
Wow.
So it's such an open section.
Cool section of the draw, actually. Okay, so we then had, whilst all this fun was going on, we had Marin Cilic getting through that match against Roberto Bautista Agut in 5. That was pretty emotional out there, wasn't it?
Well, I was editing the previous podcast and occasionally looking up at my screen. Every time I was looking up, Marin Cilic was eyes bulging, veins popping, smacking winners, playing like 2014 US Open. I think he reeled off 11 games in a row in the middle of the match and then just about managed to squeeze through the end against Bautista Agut. And it did feel like a bit of a career correction almost, because he's had so many tight losses in 5 sets, Cilic. That's kind of how I think of him over this last couple of years. He's kind of blowing leads. As harsh as that may sound, and yet for him to sort of convert this one, I think is pretty important for him.
Mm. I owe both of them an apology, because when that match was just starting on Melbourne Arena, Serena was in a deciding set. Caroline Wozniacki was at, I think, 5-5. No, actually, because it followed the Wozniacki match onto Melbourne Arena, didn't it? So I think it was just Serena that was happening. It was nearing its conclusion. And I said, how many people do you think are watching Cilic Bautista Agut right now? And to be fair, you, David, said count the stadium and that's it. And that probably was the case. But they made it something that, I mean, I was gripped by that 5th set. I was completely gripped.
As was the stadium. I mean, there were quite a few people in there. Okay, well, and Cilic won. That's a big deal for him. Really pleased for him.
He did have pretty heavy treatment on two different body parts, though. And that's back-to-back five setters.
You sure? I was up to about five body parts.
Yeah. Two minimum.
It's getting on a bit. Okay, well, so he's through. And we then had Stefanos Tsitsipas against Milos Raonic. Now, I take no pleasure in getting that prediction right, for once. Not that I've got anything against Milos Raonic. He's a nice bloke. And look, that's 2 years in a row that he's beaten the ATP Finals champion at the Australian Open. He stuffed Alexander Zverev a year ago, and now he's gone and beaten Stefanos Tsitsipas in straight sets. And it wasn't close. Tsitsipas just about hung in two of the sets with his serve, but he got nowhere near Raonic's serve. The only time he got anywhere near it was when he was 40 love down, set point down, I think, in the second set, and he made three returns and saved about four set points, but eventually didn't win that game. Raonic just had the formula. He knew what to do. He just served big, came in when he could, hit his ground strokes, and just dominated. And I thought it was quite a jarring defeat for Tsitsipas. His return was shown up big time.
He needs a block return.
Big time. He just needs to start the point. He's not even getting in points against Raonic's serve. And he said he felt stupid returning it.
I'm trying to remember Wawrinka's blocked return. I don't think he always had that.
No, he's developed it.
His is more of a chip, though, isn't it? He kind of just really digs into it to get the spin on it and get it floating.
But on the forehand side, he also has that kind of scoop thing. I mean, people have different varieties of a sort of bunt it. When you've got big, extravagant swings, it's you know, you need to find a version of your block, bunt, chip, whatever you want to call it, return, and he doesn't have that. No. And the bad news for him is that it's mid-January or end of January, and like, when's the next sort of training block he's going to have to... I mean, developing a new shot.
Incredibly difficult.
We were just talking about
how
few players it feels like he's come up against that are like Raonic. So I think maybe there hasn't been a premium on him trying to find this solution, whereas now I think this will probably be a bit of an eye-opener to him.
Yeah, I mean, long-term, I'm not... Mm. I don't think this is too concerning of a result for Tsitsipas. I think style-wise, it's a concern, and there are players on tour like Raonic who he could come up against.
I mean, he said himself, I'll just win it next year.
I'll just win it next year, I'll be fine.
Which is incredibly un-Tsitsipas.
Yeah, where's the deep, dark depression for the next week?
Should we be concerned?
I am.
Although he was asked, were you healthy? And he said, healthy in what way?
And he also said, when you play against someone like Raonic, I just become monotonic. I think that's the right word to use.
Oh, bless.
I do hope he's not caught some ATP Finals winner's curse, because Dimitrov didn't do too well. Zverev didn't do too well. It's not started too well for Tsitsipas.
It's a lot of points dropping.
I tell you what.
Got to monitor that.
How good is that from Raonic, who's had a horrible time with injuries? And actually, I noticed he put out an Instagram over the Christmas period, and he just looked so happy because he was injury free. In this post, he looked he couldn't contain how happy he was, because he was clearly training full on and not injured. And in the first two rounds here, he had straight sets wins whilst Tsitsipas had that walkover. And he also had a first round match against, I think, Salvatore Caruso, I think it is. And it just wasn't a test in any way. So I think those two things factored into this. Raonic was match tight and ready. Tsitsipas was underdone.
Agreed.
And then he was suddenly attacked by this guy with this massive game.
And it's been really noticeable how absent Raonic has been with these team competitions we've had, where Canada have played such a big part of both of them, but obviously particularly the Davis Cup finals, but they also gave a good account of themselves at the ATP Cup. And Raonic just wasn't there.
Yeah.
And you think,
and nobody was even talking about the fact that Raonic wasn't there.
Yeah,
I hadn't thought about it until you just said it.
It kind of struck me today.
He was like the other Canadian that nobody remembers.
Yeah. Which must have been so tough for him.
Absolutely.
So tough, that.
Mm. But
because I don't think he's ever denied the call up to play Davis Cup or team competition. I can't think of, I think he's always been there to.
And I do really think that Shapovalov and Oger Eliassim are young enough that they do think of Raonic as a really important figure for them. You know, when Raonic was kind of bursting through in 2012, 2013, that would have been really inspiring for Oger Eliassim and Shapovalov. He is a figurehead, a statesman for Canadian tennis. And yet, there seems to be this real obsession, and it's perfectly understandable because they've got so many exciting young players with this new youth movement in Canada, with obviously Shapovalov, Oger Eliassim, and Andreescu.
If you don't have a hashtag, then
you're not a thing.
Although Raonic,
does Raonic have a hashtag?
He had Believe in the Sleeve.
Yeah, that was rocking for a while. So anyway, he's through. Who's he playing?
Čelić.
Oh, right. Okay.
Mm. The most positive spin that the announcer could put on that was, hopefully there'll be lots of aces for the bushfires.
That's true, yeah, that'll generate a bit. Okay, well done Milos Raonic, well done Marin Cilic, and, try not to get too down, Stefanos.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast. Alongside my good friend, John Calipari, I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Which leads us on to Roger Federer against John Millman tonight, which was an absolute epic. I commentated on three of the sets on BBC Radio. I mean, the final set was one of my favourite sets of commentary in such a long time. I mean, the quality wasn't always the highest. There were some wonderful moments, but the drama that it created, and it was excruciating, really, in terms of the tension. I can't think of too many times that I've felt that on the edge of my seat in a set.
Agreed. It was close to perfect from a drama point of view, because you had them breaking each other, breaking back. Every time Federer went to hit a forehand, I feel when Zverev has to hit a second serve, like disasters around the corner. He was just missing so many forehands, Federer, and Millman was really exploiting that, targeting it, breaking it down. And you had this fascinating situation with the crowd, something I've never really seen Federer in before.
When you were in the stadium.
Yeah, and he's not the complete overwhelming favourite. I actually thought it was pretty much 50-50. John Millman went into press and thought that Federer had more. And
John Millman.
He sounded a little bit annoyed about it as well.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm pleased he sounded annoyed about it.
He said a bloke in the front row was heckling him. And he said, and then I said something back.
I thought for most of the match that the crowd were more on Federer's side. And then there was a point when Millman hit a couple of incredible winners late on, I think, in the fourth set when he was taking it into a fifth. And there may well have been a bit of, let's just have a fifth set because it'll be great. But I got the sense that there were some people that might have been on the fence, Aussies, who suddenly thought, this guy is one of us and he's just doing us proud. And they just were on their feet. And it was a cool atmosphere.
It was, it really was. And he was playing out of his mind, John Millman.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy...
Federer couldn't believe it, could he? No. How well the guy was playing.
No, this is a guy, John Millman, who 2 weeks ago at the ATP Cup was pushed to a final set tiebreak against the other Greek. The guy that got Tsitsipas into the competition.
The guy that, if you can name that person, then... there's something wrong with you.
yeah, literally the other Greek.
The bloke they'd rounded up from, like, a suburban Athens tennis club.
Yeah, and here he is pushing Federer to the brink.
John Millman is the guy that 5 years ago was so injured that he gave up tennis and just got a job in an office for about a year. He was injured, he knew he couldn't come back, and he just thought, oh, I'll just ask my brother-in-law if I can have a job. And so he went and got an office job, and he was wearing a suit and tie, and he was in his 20s. And
Someone, just close your eyes and try and picture John Millman in a suit and tie. It doesn't
Impossible.
Compute.
No.
And bless him, you know, he came back, and it took him a long while to make any inroads, really. Because he's got a meat and potatoes game, hasn't he? It's just... he's a strong, solid baseliner who'll run all day and hit the ball hard and try and pass you. But he looked so much more than that today.
It makes it all the more intriguing how he manages to cause Federer so many problems. Because occasionally you get a meat and potatoes player that Federer just wipes the floor with. Just
Steve Johnson.
For example.
But Federer won tonight, and yet he still doesn't know how to beat him.
No,
really,
he's kind of fascinated by how John Millman's game does that to him.
The amount of different approaches that Federer took to try to win points today, and still found himself on the losing end, or you know, Millman might hit an error, but he couldn't put him away.
I've never seen Federer passed so much. Maybe against Nadal on a clay court, I suppose. But on a hard court where Federer comes forward, normally he comes forward and takes over the net. But he was coming forward and Millman was just picking him off, just reading him time and time again. Federer wasn't getting the clean strike on the ball when he was coming forward. And, he just looked stunned by what Millman was able to do to him.
Is he in his head?
I think he is.
I think he was. Yeah, a big part of that though is that Federer had no timing today.
No,
throughout the whole match he was searching, and there were a lot of similarities to the match at the U.S. Open. Maybe not. He didn't completely drain away physically because he actually ended up. Dominic Inglot, who was with us, said that he felt almost as though Federer just saved himself a bit for the end. In case he needed it for a sort of 4-all, 5-all, 6-all tiebreak, because he suddenly got a bit of adrenaline in order to finish the match and actually win it. But you know how we talked at that US Open about how he was bailing out of rallies and there was almost petulance in the ground strokes. It's just a complete refusal to compromise and dig himself in and concentrate on a point. He was just irritated by his own inability to time the ball. But he wasn't prepared to compromise any of it. He was just angry at the fact that it wasn't happening. So he just kept on doing it, and it kept failing. I don't know how Federer won the match, because I think he was the second best player on the court tonight. And I think John Millman will probably go to bed tonight really unsure of how he lost.
But by his own admission... had it been a normal tiebreak, he wouldn't have won the match. And I think it was a fantastic advert for the 10-point tiebreak.
Agreed.
It just...
8-4, and then it became 8-6.
It allows... It makes it more of a mini set.
Yes.
It allows for momentum swings.
Yeah.
And
it's the best.
I do wonder if the US Open will take note. Because, I mean, I've always been in favour of a final set tiebreak. but I'm really won over and by the 10-point title.
It elevates it a bit, yeah. And it separates it a bit.
And I remember thinking in the Wimbledon final, obviously that's at 12-all, how anticlimactic that 7-point tiebreak felt at that stage of the match. I know it wasn't a very good tiebreak and it could have been more dramatic, but I just think 10 points, you give it that chance to be something more significant and grander.
If someone goes 7-2 or 7-3 I'm sure there are stats on this, but 7-2, 7-3 6-2, let's say. It's late, folks. In a normal tiebreak, I mean, the chances are that's not swinging. Mm. But I mean, it all feels on the table in a 10-point tiebreak. The drama remains alive.
And Milman, as you said, David, will be completely haunted by. I think he served both points at 8-5 and missed ground strokes long. And you said on our WhatsApp, I just can't imagine Milman losing this by getting tight. But I think on those 2 points, he did, because really? Federer didn't do anything really.
He did.
And, you know, he just. It was that will haunt him. And then the match point, I mean, you're hoping that the match is going to end on something magnificent, and it did, because Milman hit a ball to the baseline that all the Federer fans in the crowd screamed that it was out. But Federer somehow dug it back and just sort of looped it up into the middle of the court, and then Milman had a mid-court forehand. And Federer just had to guess, and he picked the right way and just leant on a forehand and nailed it. It was probably the best forehand he hit all night. Nailed it into the corner diagonally. And I tried to take a picture of the moment, and the bloke stood up in front of me. So I've got this really poor picture. But I think it captures the moment of panic quite well. Federer's just, you can't even see him. just the bloke's head's in the way. But that was that kind of night where everything was off.
Matt Roberts, not a photographer.
No, really not.
I think, I mean, we need to talk more about sort of the implications of this for Federer and his tilt at the title. But I think that there's always that balance, and we had it with Wong and Serena earlier, of you don't want to take too much away from the opponent. So perhaps we wrap up tribute to John Milman with, and I hope I'm not speaking beyond my brief here, because my dad hasn't actually said this to me, but I feel pretty confident that if he had to pick one human being to be on the boat with him forevermore on this planet, it would be John Milman. And he will correct me if I have spoken beyond my brief, because he gives feedback on the podcast every day,
as we know.
Stop laughing.
I really
well, that's a great tribute.
There is no greater compliment.
Yeah, well done, John Milman, and unlucky.
So is this going to help or hinder Roger Federer?
Two things about Federer tonight that occurred to me. A, at times I felt he looked old for a tennis player.
His hair's thinning a bit.
Well, you know, yes, it has been for a bit, hasn't it?
He's been disguising it.
He did look a bit old today. But then when he was walking off the court, having won a 5-setter, I thought, he's 38. And it's incredible.
It is incredible.
And he looked giddy about it. He looked... I think this means so much to him. Winning this in five, you know, against a guy that got the better of him physically so patently and so just so obviously last time around. I know the conditions were pretty unique that day in New York, but I think this, if he can recover physically, and that is a huge if, mentally, I think it's massive.
I think as he approaches the next one, in this next couple of days, I agree with you, because I think that this will infuse him to think that he somehow won that when he kind of got out of jail. You know, he shouldn't have won, and he did win. When he was in the interview afterwards, I think he was giddy in terms of being just lightheaded. I think the whole thing had exhausted him to such an extent, and the stress, and it all came out, because the quote... You started this podcast with it. The demons are always lurking. They're always there. And it shows you, there's this lovely image that people have of him just serenely going about his business and beating people as though it's no problem at all. Everything is calculating and going around in that brain of his. It's not what these people think. So much goes into this.
And also, as you said, so much of the narrative about Federer is the effortlessness of it all. But with this match today, Federer has now played more five-setters than anyone ever.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
Have you gone early on Matt's stat?
Possibly.
Have you double-checked that? That's an extraordinary stat.
Yeah.
I mean, he has played more tennis than, like, anyone ever.
But still.
Yeah. So
Jimmy Connors has played a fair bit.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I think Hewitt was next. Could we
do it as a percentage of matches played?
It might be at slams. I imagine Connors maybe played more five-setters when there was five-set tennis.
I think this was something like his 54th.
Yeah, something like that. Match. Anyway, wow. So we do think of Federer as winning effortless, and he does a lot of the time. But he also he's a magnet for epics. He really is. He plays so many of them, and he loses a lot of them. Hmm. And I think those demons he talks about, he has, as much as he's won more than any male tennis player ever, it almost feels like he's lost more as well, because he's been in so many finals, particularly against Federer and Nadal, which have been close, and he's lost.
Djokovic and Nadal.
Sorry, yep. Djokovic and Nadal. Mm. It's late, folks.
That's what we should call this podcast.
If I have to correct Matt, then it's really late.
but I just think you can see the stress on Federer in those tight moments, because he has lost a lot of them. And
it makes me look back on the days when I couldn't understand Federer because he seemed so inhuman.
Too good.
Feel a long time ago.
Oh, it was a long time.
And I know
ago.
The stress was there. I know now that it was all there. You just couldn't see it as clearly. No.
That was our first big argument 11 years ago.
But you had experiences. You knew him, and yes. you didn't see on the court. You never saw that. You never saw what you had seen. Mm-hmm. And I'm not. I see the look you're giving me.
Well, she wasn't having it still, you know.
I wasn't saying you're wrong. I was saying I can't feel it. I cannot feel it in my bones when I'm watching Roger Federer. Because I haven't experienced it. I just...
Understood.
But oh, God, it's like 11 years ago all over again. I'm glad I haven't got my glasses on, so I can't really see how you're looking at me right now. Yeah, but you see it now.
I was really reminded today several times of how long you two have worked together. Because you both had exactly the same idea at exactly the same time on multiple occasions on our WhatsApp group.
Except David took it that bit further.
What did I do?
I said, when the Serena and Wozniacki stories happened simultaneously, I said, we should do a two-parter podcast. We should record. We need to deal with this now so we capture the immediacy of it. And you said, yeah, great. Should we? And we both were typing, shall we do it outside in Garden Square at the same time? And then you arrived in person, and your first words were, I've had an idea. We should do two podcasts.
Yeah. Well, you told me to have a good night's sleep, and I did. This is what happened.
The result.
Sorry. Okay, is there anything else? Who's he play next?
So Federer plays Vukcevic.
Oh, crikey, he's been beating everybody.
Been the next-gen slayer, who's beaten Sinner, Shapovalov, and whatever was left of Tommy Paul.
I'm trying to think. Federer's age almost adds up to the three.
Yeah,
days.
It literally does. Yeah.
Okay, so Vukcevic against Federer. He's
physical.
Isn't going to be easy either, is it?
No, Vukcevic is a real unit.
But Federer needs to come out.
Struff type.
If Federer comes out and feels it again. He can still beat him.
Oh, yeah.
He can turn it on. I mean, it's not a switch, but it's sort of, if he feels it, it's a different match.
It's, for me, the biggest thing about 38-year-old Federer is the consistency is not quite there. You know, he can come out and play a match like he did against Krajinovic and look young in that. Everything was flowing. And then he can come out against Milman, okay, a different matchup, and look old. And I don't think you can quite be sure anymore which Federer is going to take to the court.
The one other thing just to bear in mind, I think, as well, are the playing conditions. They had this green set court this year, so they've had it the same as all the other tournaments in this swing. Daniela was saying that it is slow. The court surface is slow, and Dominguez was saying the same. And then the balls, which everybody's saying are incredibly quick when they first come out of the can, and then within about 4 minutes, they fluff up and they go slow.
Mm. Well,
Milman. Yeah.
Australian in ball tampering drama.
Why?
Scandal. He was, and this is as far as I can tell, completely within the rules, and he wasn't doing it on the sly. He was doing it quite openly.
It's also a little bit gross.
It's revolting.
Yeah.
Absolutely revolting. He was rubbing, prior to serving, he was rubbing the balls on his sweaty shirt. Which, I mean, logically, I would think that would slow them down.
I think he wanted them slow for the rallies, right?
Right.
I think he was thinking, I get my serve in, and then I'm in a rally with a slow, heavy ball.
Right, yeah. He wasn't trying to cover it up. He was just doing that.
Guess you must be allowed to.
Just rubbing his bodily fluids onto the tennis ball.
Which then... ball kids and people have to touch.
Absolutely. Ew. Disgusting.
Okay. So we'll wait to see what tomorrow brings. What will tomorrow bring?
There is one other line from today, which I only know half of it because so much has happened. But we should mention that defending men's doubles champions Mo and Herbert are out.
Oh, are they?
In round one. I say I only know half of it because I can only remember that they lost to Pear. And someone. I can't remember who Pear was playing with.
Pear, who two nights ago, after his singles loss, posted a video of himself having what looked like a pretty wild night.
He's having a cracking time.
Ben no longer focusing on singles or doubles.
Benoit Pear and
needs to find something else to focus on.
Simone Bolelli.
That's it.
Former Australian Open doubles champion with Fabio Fognini.
Beat Herbert and Mahut 6-4, 7-6. So there you are.
I think Mo and Herbert, this sounds insane because it's a Grand Slam, but I think they have the other priorities, and I really think it's the Olympics for them this year because they've won all four slams, and that would, I mean, they're already probably one of the best doubles teams in recent years. Of all time, maybe they've won all four slams, but if they could win the Olympics as well, that would massively elevate them.
Yeah. Okay, right. Saturday. We start on Rod Laver Arena with Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova against Karolina Pliskova. Then it is Yulia Putintseva against Simona Halep. Now, the big sunken rallies in that.
Mm.
Rafael Nadal against Pablo Carreño Busta, and an evening session, Svitolina Muguruza. Who's winning that? We haven't done our predictions for the newsletter yet, which you can sign up to free and get every day and get my rubbish predictions.
Full disclosure, I've not seen any of Svitolina this tournament.
No, nor have I.
I saw her in the first round against Katie Bolter.
I've seen quite a lot of Muguruza, and I had Svitolina Pliskova as my quarterfinal, so I'm going to stick with Svitolina, but with that caveat.
If Muguruza turns it on. And then it's Daniel Medvedev against, is it Alexei Popperin?
Yeah, yes. That's it, isn't it? That could be quite fun, I think.
Mm. Mm. Popperin goes for it, sometimes coached by Pat Cash, or he has been helped by him. Margaret Kvaratskhelia, Camilla Giorgi against Angelique Kerber, Belinda Bencic, Annette Kontaveit, Taylor Fritz, Dominic Thiem. That could be interesting.
Yeah, will Fritz be in a Tommy Paul-esque situation today?
Yeah, he lost in straight sets badly, didn't he, Tommy Paul, today. Verdasco against Verev. Diaz.
Yeah, I feel like Diaz and Bertens, who are second on the it Margaret Court Arena?
That's a stitch up.
They should probably bring a sleeping bag, is what you're saying.
I mean, Verdasco and Zverev
you cannot put a women's match on after Verdasco Zverev.
No.
It's unacceptable. Mm. That should be first.
I agree. Monfils Golbis. Crikey, what is this? 2009?
Yeah.
I feel conflicted about Monfils Gulbis. I think a lot of people will sort of circle that as their match of the day. And I think it
could be weird.
It could be weird and wonderful, but it's just not a match that draws me in.
It's going to be an anxiety dream.
That
whole thing.
Too much going on.
Mertens Bellis. We talked about Bellis. What a brave story that is. And pretty heartbreaking at times. Brilliant she's got back out there. Kyrgios against Khachanov
be, assuming there are further matches after tomorrow, and that's not a given, assumption. It'll be his last match on Melbourne Arena.
Yeah. Before he might face Nadal. Sounds like the bin men are coming by this.
Oh, I often go to sleep here thinking that I've outlasted the bin men.
Isner against Wawrinka is on tomorrow.
Which is on, I think, court 3, which is not the biggest court. And I would not want to be facing John Isner's serve on that court. No. There's not a lot of room there.
David Goffin against Andre Rublev. Remember when we highlighted that at the start of the tournament about the PlayStation rallies to expect.
Hopefully Goffin's fit. Last I saw of him, he was lying on his back receiving treatment in a fifth set against the aforementioned Pierre Huguet-Bert.
Crikey. Oh dear, that sounds ominous. Okay, well that's another 48 minutes to add to the 30 of earlier. So hope you've enjoyed your bumper pack of tennis podcasts today, folks. I think we've done what we needed to do because it was one of the all-time days, I would say, in terms of just stuff that's happened.
From my point of view, it's the best day I can remember in a slam.
Matt did a tweet from the tennis podcast account saying this is the best day at a slam since... as in reply with your submissions, and then he replied to himself from his personal account in caps just saying forever.
There's a chance I might be high on tennis.
Yes, let's stop the podcast and drink beer. So we'll be back tomorrow. We've loved it today. Hope you have as well. Hope you've enjoyed our two podcasts. So don't forget, you can go and listen to the whole Serena and Wozniacki chat on our other one, Two in a Day. Don't expect this every day. We'll decide. The look they're giving me. Tell your friends about the tennis podcast. Tell everybody you know. Tell random people that you see in day-to-day life in the shop. And get them to listen to the tennis podcast. Leave us a review on iTunes. We like all that. And sign up to the newsletter. Join the community in Reddit. I don't even know what Reddit is.
Apparently, over 400 members now.
Yeah, apparently it's really good. Everybody talks to each other about the tennis podcast and about stuff in tennis. And I'm getting closer to having to do my Ask Me Anything.
You are.
Which puts the fear of God into me, I have to say.
Yes, because anyway, normally we have editorial control over the questions.
Oh dear. And that's about the size of it. That's another edition of the Tennis Podcast. We will be back tomorrow with another one, and we can't wait to bring it to you. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.